From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on October 15th in California when Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill that will allow residents of California to use a third gender option on driver's licenses and birth certificates. The previous options were male and female, but beginning in 2018, California residents can select non-binary. Governor Brown said that law will now respect Californians who do not identify as male or female. And in last July, Last July, Oregon became the first state to allow residents to mark their gender as not specified on driver's licenses. Oregon allows residents to mark an X in the category of gender instead of choosing an M or an F. Advocates say California goes further, and this is helping to set a standard that other states can follow. Democratic State Senator Tony Atkins told CNN, quote, "I want to thank Governor Brown for recognizing how difficult it can be for our transgender, non-binary, and intersex family members, friends, and neighbors when they don't have an ID that matches their gender presentation," end quote. So should we expect other states, like New York, to follow California? And what other institutions could follow? Harvard University allows students to identify from a much wider range of gender identities than just male or female, and more colleges are adopting those options. But there's been some opposition in California and Oregon. The California Family Council opposed the new law, telling the San Francisco Chronicle that the law, quote, "advances a lie that being male or female or no gender at all is a choice each person has a right to make," end quote. And the council warns that there will be opposition anywhere lawmakers attempt to pass these kinds of bills. My guest this hour will help us understand the perspectives of the LGBTQ community. In studio, I'm joined by Milo Primo, an LGBT rights staff attorney at the Empire Justice Center and a transgender rights advocate. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Genesis Nunley is a third-year law student at the University of Buffalo and a restaurant worker in Rochester. Welcome back to you.
Hi there.
So we will also be joined shortly by a phone guest in California who can tell us about the reaction in communities there. But listeners, I'd like to invite you to join this conversation. You can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org. And you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So I shared some of the reaction that we heard in California after Governor Brown passed that new law. And I'll turn to my guest because we've seen that when there are issues about transgender rights or policies in the news, we hear a variety of reactions. And some are loving and supportive, others are hostile. What have you observed in our community here about that news? Go ahead, Genesis.
Okay. Well, first off, I think there's the idea is that non-binary identities are new, and that's completely untrue. And I think I've learned a lot about that because we have a very high Native population, and the Two-Spirit population, like here, is also incredibly active. And so I think...
Oh, just get closer to your mic.
Oh, sorry. And I think point of contention is just to stress that non-binary identities have always existed. Like, this is not something that is new. This is not something that is novel. And I do appreciate California's actions, with regards to actual, palpable identification. But this is something that has just always existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to piggyback off of that, I would say, in the work that I do, I work with at least over 100 trans people per year with a variety of issues, helping with legal name changes and discrimination issues. And in this past year alone, I would say that somewhere probably between 30 to 40% of my transgender clients have identified as non-binary, which is just to say that they don't necessarily identify as male or female or something in between or all of the above. And, it's been a great frustration that their gender expansiveness is not something that can be accurately depicted on identity documents and vital records, which are the things that get us into housing. It's the things that get us jobs. It's what allows us to navigate the world on a daily basis. So I've heard a lot of excitement and enthusiasm from the community about this and hope that maybe this is something that we can bring to New York.
I'm so glad you mentioned that because this new law is more than legal documentation changing. It affects people's daily lives, and I think that's easy for some people to miss. An advocate for transgender youth in San Diego told the New York Times, that, quote, you don't get to decide, they don't get to decide for you based on what you're assigned at birth, meaning the people who make these policies and documents. And this person continued to say, someone can go into a new job as non-binary and have paperwork to back that up, and there's no way for the employer to know. So it gives people freedom that they didn't otherwise have before. And I know that the birth certificate component of the law has been particularly celebrated. Milo, can you walk us through how that process will work if people in California decide I want to change my gender identity on my birth certificate?
Well, you know, I'm not too familiar with the way it's working in California. I think that they have an administrative process, as far as I understand it, so that, there's no need to have a judge determine for you that your gender has changed, that you're able to self-assert that and swear that it's true and that's enough, which is... I think that's the way it should be. I don't think we should really have to jump through a lot of hoops and ask people in robes or in doctor's outfits to give us permission to be ourselves. So I think that that's the way it should work. Here in New York, our New York State birth certificates and New York City birth certificates can also be changed through an administrative process at this point. It's just an application that you fill out, but it does have to have a doctor's letter to go with it. Hmm. If we are able to add a non-binary option to it, I think that it would probably look very similar to that.
Mm-hmm. I think this is something I read in the New York Times. It says, until now, people who wanted to obtain a non-binary gender designation had to get a physician's affidavit stating they had undergone treatment for the purpose of gender transition.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And I do appreciate what California is doing now and also what New York does in that it taking away the aspect of like medical transition makes it a lot more accessible towards different people because that requires money. So that means that like the people who are able to medically transition or the people who are able to like actively do so will have a different like socioeconomic status, which disadvantages people who may not have that same sort of access. And so allowing people to self-designate like through an administrative process means a lot more accessibility and a lot more recognition for people who might not have had the same agency.
Yeah, if I can piggyback off of that, I'm really glad that you brought that up. You know, the most recent study and the largest national study of transgender people across the country, just about 28,000 of them, you know, said that 9 out of 10 trans people walk around the world with mismatching identity documents. And part of that is, yeah.
Oh, right. Jen, you're pointing to yourself.
Well, yeah. We're both, yeah, no, me too. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. And part of that is because, you know, we were born in states or live in states that make it impossible or very, very difficult to obtain accurate identity documents because of the doctor's letters or our ability to access medical care that would be respectful or competent in serving trans people, or even just the desire to even want to undergo certain treatments that may or may not be for you as an individual, right? But also in states that don't recognize or don't allow any gender marker changes, like Ohio, for example. Or if you're a non-binary person or an intersex person living in a state, which is the vast majority of them now still, where there is not an option for you. You have to fall into one or two categories and that's it.
Do you consider this a major victory? Is this a marathon? And are we excited about this victory? Or should it be more like a sprint? How are you viewing this as a, on the whole?
I'm cautious, because naturally I have to be. It's one of those things where I'm very appreciative that that California and other states are allowing more accessibility, but that also does not change existing systems. Like, for example, when I go into the airport and they have to do the scan thing, I don't know, like, people who are cis or may not be necessarily read as trans, they do select whether they're supposed to scan you as male or female, which is very awkward because that means that they go via the license that I have, but then also the person who's scanning me might go like for what they see, which means that like certain I'm appreciative that IDs will change, but that does not change existing systems that are quite like a little bit difficult.
Right. Mm-hmm. We live in a very strictly binary system in all aspects of our lives, and I think that as a whole, society takes that for granted because it isn't an issue for a lot of people in society, but for transgender and non-binary folks, it's an issue in almost every facet of life in a way that really permeates everything and makes it hard just to navigate the day.
Well, joining us on the phone now from California is Toby Adams. She's the executive director and legal director of the Intersex and Genderqueer Recognition Project. Toby, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Toby, what is IGRP?
iGroup, as I call it, is the very first organization in the United States focused entirely on the legal rights of non-binary people. We were founded by intersex and genderqueer people who identify with a non-binary gender.
Mm-hmm. Being in California and having this new law passed, what are some of the reactions that you're hearing, especially as the executive director of iGroup?
Well, actually, iGroup worked quite a bit on the new law. We were there for lobby days for all of the committee hearings. And one of the things that we found that was really encouraging was that this was really it was not a partisan issue. Although we did have all of the Democrats in the committees voting in favor of this law, we also had several Republicans voting in favor of this law. And this really is about respecting people for who they are and for identifying themselves as who they are. And I really think that that goes across our society as an important point that everyone, especially non-binary people who aren't currently respected, need to be respected for their own identity.
I'm sure you've heard some of the pushback that has been out there. There's a conservative group called SaveCalifornia.com that expressed concerns that the new law, which eliminates the needs for a physician's letter in support of a gender transition, could lead to identity fraud. That's what they're saying. Milo, I see you shaking your head.
Okay. They're really stretching there. They actually, during the hearings, they sent people in opposition, and it was interesting because there'd be one or two of them in opposition and 100 of us in support, but they changed their argument each time, and they eventually landed on identity fraud because their first argument was there are only male and female physically, so there can only be male and female gender identities, and then our intersex members spoke at these hearings, and that was blown out of the water. And then they kept changing what their argument was, and they landed on identity fraud, but there is no proof or no real risk of that.
Mm-hmm. Milo.
Oh,
and Genesis both had very strong reactions to that.
No, it's just the likelihood of somebody subjecting themselves to the exorbitant and multifaceted amount of discrimination and harassment and bias and violence that comes with being a trans person or a non-binary person or an intersex person. And to do that voluntarily for the sake of committing fraud, right? Nobody does that. That's not a real thing.
Exactly. Like, I can't get over that. Like, identity fraud, like, of all things. Like, if I love and appreciate everything that I am, like, being a non-binary person of color. But, like, would that I could have the ease of not having to do all of that? Like, this is nothing that is done because I, like, want to just do it or because I want to commit some sort of, like illegal act. Just like that is definitely grasping at straws at best,
right? And it's perpetuating this idea that the premise that there are only two sexes, are only two genders, there are only two ways, masculine and feminine, to express those genders to the rest of the world. And we know that that isn't true. We know that people exist in between and outside of that. And to continue to kind of push that argument in this day and age is just so ludicrous. It's
farcical, and like in a way, because like people have such like weirdly tied ideas tied towards what men and women like should and should not do. And we live in an era where like people are not relegated to like whatever quote unquote biological like realities that they have. It doesn't make sense anymore. But I don't agree with the pushback, but I also understand when people are pushing back because this is something people are trying to compartmentalize and make sense of their day to day. But we don't live in that reality anymore.
Well, I think a lot of it has
part of it.
Sorry,
oh,
Toby.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say, I think that part of that is that the people who are pushing back see this as a fact when really it is a social construct.
Exactly.
And as Genesis, I believe, pointed out at the beginning, it came in when the white settlers took over in our country from the native people who had been here, who had identified and respected five genders.
Right.
And it was the society that came in and inflicted the binary in this country. It's not a fact, it's a social construct.
Right, like that's even reflected in initial like Chinese immigration. The fashions that were popular within like that era of China were very much neutral, but the Victorian ideals of like Western settlerism, Westernism, were inflicted upon them in order to more effectively delineate. And like basically, almost every other country or every other continent in the world has an understanding of gender that is not so explicitly binary.
Well, we have a caller on the line who has a comment about other countries. This is Joan in Henrietta. Hi, Joan.
Yeah, hi. I work for an organization that is very tolerant and supportive of LGBTQ people, and I am myself. But through my company, because we are a global company, I learned that there are a number of countries, some of them in the Middle East, where it is punishable by death to be found to be gay or otherwise. And so if people are putting on their main form of identification that they are non-binary, it would concern me that they should be very careful about traveling, and they could find out more information about that by Googling travel alerts for gay people. Or, but at any rate, it's kind of concerning that that would be one of the unintended consequences. I'm sure there might be more.
Okay, thank you, Joan.
Okay, so I definitely understand that, and unintended consequences are a thing, but I'm black, I'm a person of color, and so I know that there are places that I'm less safe in if I travel to. And so I also know that if I put non-binary, there are places that I'm less safe in traveling to. Same thing, if someone was a woman, there are places that are more difficult to travel to. And like it's sort of as if it's an immutable characteristic. And granted, I would have that on my identification, or someone else would have that on their identification, but that doesn't preclude the necessity for me to be able to accurately identify myself. Like, I know that when certain spaces, I am more or less safe, and so that is just a circumstance that I would, or other people would have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Milo?
Well, I echo that. I don't have much more to add. I would say that, you know, as a LGBTQ person, you always have to weigh the risks of any place you go to domestically or abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, having a passport that accurately reflects your gender identity, if you do fit within the binary, you know, I have a male passport. But if I were to go to certain countries and have to go to a hospital or something, I might find myself in a similar conundrum or bind. Being a transgender person, regardless of what my identity documents say. So I would almost rather have identity documents that are at least accurate, and then I can weigh the risks to myself than anything else. But I'd be interested to hear what Toby might have to say.
Yeah, go ahead, Toby.
Yes, I actually, I really locked on to that word immutable characteristics that Genesis mentioned. The point that I think that needs to get across to a lot of people, and it's very important, I think, that this be covered in the media accurately, is that this isn't something people are deciding to be. It's not new. It's an immutable characteristic. A non-binary person, their gender identity, that is what they are. That is an immutable characteristic. And so having accurate legal documentation to match that, although those laws are new, it's not inventing non-binary gender. the non-binary gender already exists. There are all of these people out here who have a non-binary gender and then have these inaccurate legal identification documents, their birth certificate, their driver's license, their passport. And these are all things that iGroup is working on legally, state by state, system by system, to get those legal identity documents to be allowed to match who they really are.
Mm-hmm. Joan, I'd like to thank you for that call and the discussion it's generated. And Genesis, as you said, that immutable characteristic, do you think that, I mean, we have an education issue, I think, obviously, in this realm, because people don't understand certain things. Maybe it's terminology. Maybe it's that these things are immutable characteristics. What do we need to do to bridge that divide? And that's a big question. I know that, and I'll let all of you weigh in. But especially when a new law like this is passed and there are groups like the California Family Council coming out and say, you know, now we have to change sports teams at schools, and they just don't understand certain issues. What's the best way to start breaking down some of these hurdles?
Talking. And it puts trans and non-binary people and as well as allies in a difficult situation, because you're already just trying to live your existence. But the thing that I found to be most useful is just talking. So as much as I would like for people to be able to humanize me without having to actually meet me as a human, it just helps to be able to go and speak to certain people. And every little bit helps. Like, even if it's just correcting someone who I work with about, like, yeah, like, they, like, teaching someone how to use they, them, and theirs, like, pronouns. Like, that is just something. Or even just normalizing asking for pronouns.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about that. I was talking to a friend last night. Oh, sorry, Toby, go ahead.
It's okay. It's harder being on the phone because you can't see my facial expressions. Like, I have something to say. Yeah, I just wanted to say that you had mentioned allies, and I think that that's something very important, that it's one of the things that we can do to educate is that allies really need to step up and help to get the word out there and to create the spaces for non-binary people to share their real stories and their real humanity. And also because it's, I think it really is on allies a lot to get the door open, because we're not in that space where we're in constant danger for our own identities. And I'm married to a person who's non-binary. I have several young people in my family who are non-binary. And it's important for me to help with that. The other thing I think is that the opposition is using ignorance to push forward arguments that aren't accurate. So sharing accurate facts helps. Like, for instance, they talked about sports teams at schools. They are completely misreading Title IX. Mm-hmm. There is no requirement to create non-binary sports teams. There's only a requirement to let a student be on the sports team that exists if there isn't one. So, for instance, if there isn't a women's football team in a high school, the school's not required to create a women's football team. They're just required to allow the women in those schools to try out for the football team. And so it's not true that creating non-binary legal documents means that schools have to start creating non-binary sports teams under Title IX.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, within the context of that, like, I hate the, like, well, we'll have to do more work to be more inclusive. Like, why are you so mad at that? That's right. Not really a thing. Like,
the question I had before was about pronouns. I was talking to a friend last night. He runs a queer youth group locally, and he said that he learned from the people in his group that the term preferred is not acceptable mm-hmm. anymore. When you're talking about pronouns, you shouldn't say what is your preferred pronoun, because these young people were saying they're my pronouns. I don't prefer them. They are just my pronouns. And I think we're emerging into new, you know, ways of talking about things, but that was new to me. I openly admit that. I did not know. But how do you feel how do you correct someone if I were to say something that isn't totally on par, which I may, and I apologize in advance, but how do you correct someone or help them work through something they may not understand?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of training of attorneys and judges and also folks in the community about what their rights are. And a great deal of the work that I focus on are basic, you know, respectfulness when talking with and about queer folks and trans folks specifically, and how to ask these questions in a respectful way. And I think you're pointing to a really important point, which is that the language is always changing. It is not stagnant. It is not, you know, it's very dynamic. And that's based in large part because the language we have, the words we have not been sufficient enough to adequately describe and define these experiences that exist outside of the norm and outside of hegemony. And so when we work with each other to really try to understand what the way to go about it is, and that is always changing, a really important thing to understand is that, you know, just because you go to one training or you watch one YouTube video, you are not officially, you know, in the know necessarily, that it's always important to continue to educate yourself. And really the onus is on you as an individual to educate yourself and not to expect folks who identify in the community to always come to you and explain things to you all the time. But a lot of what I do is try to call people in instead of calling them out. I give as many people as I can the benefit of the doubt to say that, you know, they probably did not mean to be offensive in this situation. If they do it repeatedly, we're going to have a longer and more serious conversation. But, you know, I also have a lot of privilege in doing that. I'm a white guy with a beard, and I'm an attorney. And so people take me seriously, and I can walk through the world with a great deal of privilege because of those identities. But not everybody in the community has that privilege and can really put themselves in a dangerous situation if they try to correct people about their pronouns. So, and other things. But as far as pronouns go specifically, I've gotten into the habit of asking people, you know, how would you like to be addressed? For example, I go by he and him, and I like to be called Milo. How about you? And that really opens the door without using the term preference.
Right. Okay. Yeah, just ask. Like, just open the conversation with that. People will try to rebuff me when I talk about non-binary identities or names that they don't recognize by saying, well, this is what I see. And it's like, well, okay, that's fine. But, like, it literally takes a step to just ask, like, what would you like me to call you? Or, like, this is what I like to be called. I run into some difficulty because I am definitely non-binary, but professionally I use he, him, his, mostly just because it, like, it lends itself to, like, to ease.
Do you think people are...
One of the things that...
Go ahead, Toby. Sorry about that.
Sorry. One of the things that we do in our meetings and our presentations here is that everybody starts their introduction with, my name is Toby and my pronouns are she, her. And then we don't assume that only non-binary people and transgender people need to identify their pronouns in a meeting. Everybody does. It's not an outing kind of a thing. It's everybody identifies our pronouns.
Right, exactly. Because when people think about non-binary identities and or just like asserting your pronouns, they assume specifically transgender people. But a variety of cis people look a variety of different ways and also identify as a variety of different ways. Like, for example, my church, I go to Open Arms, is like we have a large LGBT community and we have name tags where it has the name and the pronouns. Like, just to clarify, like, everything, not going to leave anything up to chance.
Do you think some people are embarrassed to ask, though? How do we overcome the stigma of asking, if that's such a thing?
Yeah, they are. And also, I know as a person who is sort of middle of the road, like, when someone asks me something, I have, like, the warning, like, lights going on. Because I just, like, I hope that they're asking respectfully. But I would just prefer people asked. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just something, just, like, put it out in the open, I will tell you, and then we can move along.
Yeah. Go ahead, Toby.
I think the most respectful thing you can do is to start out the ask by saying, "This is who I am. Who are you?
Right.
Like, my name is this. What's your name? Yeah. My pronouns are this. What are yours?"
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every single person I've ever trained on this stuff is very eager to know how to do it well and how to do it respectfully. There's usually very little resistance. Well, I'm not going to do this. Why do I have to do it? You know, there's actually a sense of relief, like, oh, thank goodness. I knew that I needed to do this. I just didn't know how. And so I think what my friends here are saying is absolutely right. You know, normalizing it, making something that you do every time in every meeting, putting it as part of your email signature at work or your personal email is a really great way to do it. It sends a signal out that this is something you've thought of and you know that's important. And also making sure that trans people, non-binary people, but also non-transgender people or cisgender people are all doing it together so that it's not a system of outing anybody in the room. It's setting the stage of respect across the board so that everybody feels comfortable at the outset about who they are and how to respectfully address each other.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you have questions about anything that we're talking about, this is a safe space. It is non-judgmental. Our guests will answer your questions. And you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email your questions to connections at WXXI.org. And you can also find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. More connections coming up. We'll take our short break. And when we come back, I have some questions about if we're going to see the kinds of progress that we've seen in California in New York State. So more connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on the next Connections, a fresh look at LED lighting challenges ideas as to whether it's better for the environment. We'll look at common household items and their impact on climate. Then in our second hour, local musician Danielle Ponder has a new concert coming up, and it's called For the Love of Justice. It highlights issues like feminism, criminal justice, and racial justice. We'll preview that and talk to her about songwriting. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We are talking about a new law in California that was signed on October 15th. Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill that will allow residents of California to use a third gender option on driver's licenses and birth certificates. And joining me today on the program is Milo Primo, an LGBT rights staff attorney at the Empire Justice Center and a transgender rights advocate. Genesis Nunley is a third-year law student at the University of Buffalo and a restaurant worker in Rochester. And joining us on the phone in California is Toby Adams, the executive director and legal director of the Intersex and Genderqueer Recognition Project. So I'd like to ask my guests, because this new law in California is considered a major victory, if we expect this to happen in New York, and if we do, how long will that take? And I mentioned earlier in the program, is this a marathon? Is it a sprint? What should it be? How do you feel about that? But when might we see, if we will, such a law coming to fruition in New York?
You know, I think Toby could probably speak to about the speed with which it's happened in California and other, the strength of these efforts in other states across the country. What I can say in New York is that there is a group of advocates who are actively working on this issue. And it's something that we find very important both in downstate and upstate New York. And it's something we're taking seriously. I think that the challenge, of course, is that our current legislature is probably not one that would take up an issue like this. So a lot of the advocacy, I think, at this point involves a great deal of public education and possibly policy advocacy on the administrative side of things to see if there's some work that can be done to get policies passed that would make this whole process much more available and user-friendly for the people of New York.
Mm-hmm. Genesis and Toby, what are your thoughts on the speed at which these types of processes have moved?
Well, I could talk about the various states. There are different... The issue with getting non-binary rights is that it's not just one thing. Birth certificates are the state law in the state you were born. Driver's license is the state you live in. Passport is federal law. And each state handles their birth certificates and driver's licenses a little differently. So, for instance, in Washington, D.C., they came in very late in the game, but were the first to get the non-binary driver's licenses throughout an entire jurisdiction. I know New York City has had those before. prior to D.C., but it took a little longer in Oregon because it was regulation, and as opposed to administrative changes. And then legislation takes the longest of all. So even though California started before D.C. or Oregon working on this, it's just been signed into law. And in fact, the birth certificates won't be available until September of 2018, and the driver's license is in January of 2019. So people still have to wait a while. So we're working in different states in different areas. Washington is working on regulation, Washington State, and will very likely have non-binary birth certificates early in 2018. And Massachusetts has just submitted legislation, which, as I've said, takes longer.
Mm-hmm. Genesis.
All right. So, I mean, the pacing, of course, is like it's slower than I would like it to be. I think my major concern, well, not like real concern, is I'm fundamentally Midwestern, and a lot of these movements are very much seen as like East Coast, like coastal, like progressive politics. And so my concern is not so much the time, but more so the compartmentalization, because I'm quite concerned that things will not move more inward.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. We're seeing some changes at colleges and universities mm-hmm. across the nation, though, which I think is uplifting. For example, in 2015, during the registration process at Harvard, students are allowed to indicate which pronouns they use, which with suggested gender-neutral options. Again, that was 2015, and that year, more than 4,000 students submitted pronouns, with slightly more than 1% choosing something other than he or she. That same year, American University posted a guide on its website explaining how to use gender-neutral pronouns and how to ask someone which pronouns they use. Cornell and MIT offered similar primers on their websites. Ohio University, so we're moving more west, Genesis, let students register their gender pronouns. SUNY schools here in New York in 2015, they announced that they're working on a data collection tool to let students choose among 7 gender identities, including trans, man, questioning, and gender queer. We can check into some updates on that. But I will also say not all institutions are on board. The University of Tennessee, Knoxville, sparked outrage among state politicians in August 2015 when a post on the school website encouraged students to use gender-neutral pronouns. State senators blasted the idea and called for an investigation of the post. Days later, by order of the school president, it was taken down. So progress in some places, pushback in others. As far as institutions of higher education go, do we feel like the speed at which things are moving there is more, we're moving more quickly? Or are you frustrated by what's happening?
So without going into too much detail, my partner works within the fraternity sorority affairs at a university that is in the sort of southern part of the United States. And it is not, it's moving. It's moving, though not as quickly as would be desired. Like, it is incredibly difficult, but with regards to that specifically, as much as they can take a post down, that of course does not preclude the fact that people still exist.
Right.
You can do as much as you want to not talk about an issue, but that doesn't stop people from being there. And I think that is important to stress. While I do appreciate and want legal protection, legal representation, as taking down a post or even having people not talk about it does not erase the people who are still going to meet using these identities.
And the universities and employers is actually an area where we are working in those places where the state governments are not ready to provide the driver's licenses and birth certificates. We are seeing advances by working with employers and working with the universities. For instance, in Hawaii, the largest employer in the state is the University of Hawaii, and one of our iGroup representatives there has managed to get the University of Hawaii to recognize their third gender, and this is an intersex person who also identifies as a non-binary gender.
Do you think that that's where progress begins, at that ground up ish at the ground level? Do we need to start where we can control things more to push more state and federal legislation into place, or should we be starting from the top? What do you think is the more effective approach?
That's difficult. Also, I hear that a lot of the legislation that or regulation people are talking about is couched in universities, which also once again breeds an idea that this is an elitist thing that is only found in academia or people who are from a certain background. I think starting from the bottom helps as much as you can say. When starting from the top, you have to deal with a lot of people who are politicians, who are trying to be elected, who are trying to put forth a message that whether or not they believe in, they know they're supposed to push, which means that if you change or attempt to change the minds of the people of any layperson, then that it generally affects more effective change. While the legislation might not be there, if I feel comfortable, if someone is made to be able to feel comfortable in society, then they don't also need that additional pressure of having a hard document. Even looking at aspects of segregation tangentially, there are places where you initially an environment would have been segregated, but a neighborhood is made to feel safe. So it's if a person of color may not be legally allowed to go into some place, but if the neighborhood or the instance or circumstance allows the person to feel safe, then they are still afforded their humanity. And I think fundamentally, non-binary people, trans people just want humanity.
Mm-hmm. I also think it depends on the location. Again, in places like California, where we have a very liberal-controlled legislature, it's perfectly fine to start at the top and with changing the laws. But in places where that's not possible, I think it's very, very much the way to start is working from the bottom up with your employer, your health insurance company, your university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I totally agree with both sentiments. And, having started before law school as a community activist and public educator in Ohio, and having grown up in Texas, I can say very, very clearly that grassroots organizing and community support and advocacy and development is so hugely important in all of this. Helping people find others who are experiencing something similar to what they're experiencing, being able to find fellowship and camaraderie and courage and strength in that, and not feeling isolated. In upstate New York, there are large swaths of our state where there are not community organizations that people can turn to. Folks who cannot or are not interested or not able to attend universities, and who don't have competent, respectful doctors that they can go to within a 50-mile radius that drive all the way to Rochester to see a doctor who can treat them. And that is indicative of a lot of the Midwest, as Genesis was mentioning before, and in the South, and parts of the country where there aren't going to be governments that are going to be proactive or even reactive to the hopes and dreams of their residents. So, the grassroots organizing part of it and supporting those efforts to further educate their own communities, further educate their employers, their schools, their neighbors. As Toby was just saying, I think is so crucially important, and it's something that we can't overlook, and it's very powerful. And actually, I think that is how we've made change on so many levels in so many different social movements.
You brought up doctors, and that reminded me of conversations we've had on this program before about doctors' appointments. And some of the guests that we've had in the past have raised the idea that doctors can be too prying during exams, meaning they ask too many personal questions about gender or identity. And I read an article in Slate this morning which indicates the reasons why doctors need to be having these conversations about gender identity, sexuality, and related issues from a medical perspective. And there are new regulations that will soon require doctors to ask their patients about their gender identity because they feel like it's related to medical history. So I can read through some of the data here, but the summary is they feel like by opening these conversations, if people have been victims of, if they have attempted suicide because they feel discriminated against and they need a safe space to engage in a conversation, if they have concerns about HIV, if they've been victims of date rape, and the list goes on and on. If they're having these conversations in open, safe spaces, they're more likely to get treatment. But right now, it seems that doctors are not asking these questions. But how do you feel? I'll go around the panel. How do you feel about this issue? Do you think that doctors should be required to ask these kinds of questions?
Okay. Well, doctors are people, and I think that is always forgotten, because someone can say, that's like when someone claims to be devil's advocate, like just like, well, I'm just asking for the purposes of like medical history. But like, if it is a doctor who is like stringently conservative, that means that they're not asking that question like with like interest in medical history. They're asking that with their own biases intact. Like, so if there was a way to pose those questions, because some of them are very relevant, it is super weird to go to a doctor and have to talk about getting a pap smear and they just look at me like I'm insane. But like, they really, yeah, but they, if doctors were able to separate, which I know people are people, were able to like remove their own internalized biases with those questions, then I would be more receptive to it. But too often I find that medical professionals are unable to actually like compartmentalize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, you know, statistically speaking, you know, trans people half of the time have to educate their doctors about how to treat them,
right?
So one in every two times they go to see a doctor, they have to actually educate their doctor about how to treat their bodies. And if a non-trans person had to do that, it would be outrageous, right? Mm-hmm. There would be an uproar about the medical institution being like, what are we training them to do exactly if they don't even know how to treat me? They're supposed to be the professionals and the experts, right? Most trans people have experienced some sort of hostility in the waiting rooms, in the exam rooms, by front receptionists, from people waiting in the waiting rooms, from nurses, from doctors, in the form of misgendering, being called the wrong pronouns, from probing and invasive and inappropriate questions based on what is actually happening in the exam, from being denied altogether treatment by virtue of being a trans person, saying, well, we don't know how to treat trans people. Regardless of whatever the case might be, it could be strep throat, which seems like it kind of crosses all genders, right? to being assaulted, right? People, so the amount of microaggression and macroaggression and violence that can actually take place in medical facilities and in seeking medical treatment deters trans folks and non-binary folks from even going to see a doctor, right? Mm-hmm. And when you do, you hope with everything you have that it won't be as bad as it could be. And you, and when you leave, you're like, you know, that could have been worse, right? I can count on one hand, I'm 33 years old, I can count on one hand the number of times that I've had an excellent medical experience with a doctor, right? and again, I walk through the world with a great deal of privilege as a white guy with a law degree. So, who you know, appears as male in society with a beard. So, that is to say that I think that there are circumstances where questions might need to be asked for the purposes of doing a thorough job as a medical professional, but there is a great lack of distrust of the medical institution by trans and non-binary folks, and justifiedly so. And also, there are a lot of ways that medical professionals are not approaching it the right way. They're not asking respectfully. So I think it's a double-edged sword a little bit, and I think that the whole situation needs to be taken really contextually and approached carefully and respectfully and cautiously.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a conversation. Oops, sorry, Toby. That delay.
I'm so sorry. One thing that has been suggested to me is that doctors talk about physical organs and hormones rather than sex. So this is especially true for intersex people or people who might have had some sort of transition surgery or hormones, that it's your sex is not a one static single thing. It includes your hormones. It includes your genitals. It includes your secondary sex characteristics. It includes your chromosomes. And those don't always line up with what are assumed to be traditional male or female. And so it's respectful for a doctor, not for anybody out in the world who says, oh, what have you got underneath your pants? That's really rude. But for a doctor, they need to know, do you have a uterus? Are you taking hormones? These things are important for doctors, unless they're treating a strep throat, in which case it's probably not that relevant.
Right.
The other thing about doctors that's really important, and this kind of comes back to the California law, is that doctors do not want to be required to write these letters for people to get their legal documents changed. We've had doctors show up and testify at the hearings on the California SB 179, the new law, and say, I'm not a lawyer. This is not a place for doctors to be involved. So the self-attestation part of the new law is really important. And it also breaks down the issue with only people with financial means being able to get accurate identification. Because we've had one person in our organization who, in order to get to a doctor, had to save up all of their Social Security check money and take a bus 5 hours to get to a doctor who would give them a letter just to get their legal documents changed. And that really stands in the way of people who don't have the means or don't live in the right area getting accurate ID.
Well, thank you, Toby. We are out of time. I think that specific part of this conversation deserves its own hour. So I think I should invite you all back and we can talk about that. Just very quickly, a caller in Peña named Karen called in and wants to echo Milo's statements about the difficulties of being non-binary in a binary world. Her son is transgender, so she appreciates your thoughts there. I'd like to thank all of my guests for joining me today, Milo Primo, Genesis Nunley, and Toby Adams in California on the phone with us. Thank you all for listening. Rob Braden's our engineer. Audrey Samples, our intern. Evan Dawson will be back with us tomorrow. I'm Megan Mack. Have a great afternoon, everybody.